Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'll be speaking today with Gar Alperovitz, co-chair of the Next System Project at the Democracy Collaborative, and someone who's thinking seriously about what comes after capitalism. And you can learn more at garalperovitz.com. I'm going to give that to you again. It's GARALPEROVITZ. GarAlperovitz.com. You can also go to Democracy Collaborative. After a three-year hiatus with the election of Donald Trump, I could not resist exploring the path forward in new interviews, and this is the 30th of those. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, etc. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. And before we launch into the conversation, let me offer a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to the Trump agenda and work toward the healthy, just future we all need. Indivisibleguide.com, indivisibleguide.com. That's probably the largest, most organized political operation looking at how to resist. They will send you weekly actions and phone calls, etc. OurRevolution.com, again, one word, Our Revolution. That's a group that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Two that have been around for a long time, MoveOn.org, MoveOn.org, and Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org. MoveOn is national, Courage Campaign is California. Both of them have been primarily digital activists up until the recent election, and now they are working much more closely with the grassroots. And finally, two very specific to participating in democracy. One is Five Calls. That's the number five, and C-A-L-L-S, fivecalls.org. And they will tell you what are the most relevant calls to be making to your legislators on issues, what's most timely. And then townhallproject.com. One word, townhallproject.com. They will tell you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding meetings with the public, and right now is a period when they will be doing so. So if you're interested in seeing what your representative is thinking and let them know what you're thinking, check out townhallproject.com. Now to today's guest. As alarming as recent news has been, the separation of families at the U.S. border, the string of anti-democratic Supreme Court decisions, the retirement of swing Justice Kennedy, and the litany of terrible things that escape our attention because they're drowned out by the flashier stories and personalities every single day. As alarming and dispiriting as all that may be, we must not only do all we can to oppose and alter the bad news, but we must also envision a way out, envision a possible future for the U.S. that decent people deserve, as well as a path to get us there from here. And I would say that that is the current calling of today's guest, historian, political economist, activist, writer, Gar Alperovitz. Gar served for 15 years as a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. He's president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives and a co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, where he's co-chair of the Next Systems Project. His books include The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, America Beyond Capitalism, What Then Must We Do, and his latest, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. And that one, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth, is available as a free download at this URL, thenextsystem, all one word, thenextsystem.org/principles. Okay, free download of the whole book. Welcome, Gar Alperovitz, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Sunday, July 1st, 2018. Welcome, Gar.
Oh, glad to be with you. Thanks.
So what do you say? Am I right that that's your current calling to envision the system that's going to work and how to get there?
Well, it's one of the things I've been thinking a lot about over the last, I guess, 25, 30 years. I'm a historian as well as a political economist. Systems come and go in history. We're right in the middle of a very nasty period in American history. And it's going to get nastier, probably. So I have no illusions about the difficulties of the current moment. But I'm also cognizant of what happens as systems decay and as alienation occurs, it's possible that what you see now will last forever, but it's probable that we will move beyond to something different. And I think that's the place to look. What are the possibilities of an emergent future? What do we know about that? How do we build towards it? And what design is the right one? And let me say a word about that, because people don't often think about design in terms of the system. But in fact, we've been living with a particular form of corporate-dominated capitalism, which until recently, this is part of the design, was sort of balanced or counterbalanced by a powerful institution called the labor unions. And on top of that, there was politics that was mobilized, but the power base was big corporations on the one hand and labor unions in politics as well as on the shop floor, financing elections and so forth. If you think about Ohio, that was a state the Democrats won because it was mobilized by labor unions, and they lost it because the labor unions are gone. What is interesting about the current system, leaving aside our critiques and all the things we can say about the current incumbent of the White House, is that the institutional balance of power has disintegrated. Corporations dominate their sector, they dominate politics, they dominate the money of politics, and labor unions have gone from 34.5% of the labor force, never very powerful, the Swedes were at 80%, down to 11% of the labor force in unions and only 6% in the private sector. So the weakness of the design of that system, corporations kind of counterbalanced by some part of the organized labor, that's one of the reasons you see Donald Trump in the White House. He's exploited the possibilities and the dangers of that situation. Now, the question is, how do we go through the painful period and build and lay groundwork for the next possible transformation? It is possible that we will never move beyond where we now are at, but I think that's unlikely, and I think the question is to stand back, ask what makes sense. If you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want, and how do we get there, and what are the building blocks that are already present in the American society? And there are a lot of them just under the radar we can talk about that point in a new direction in practical terms, as well as in terms of system theory and design and strategies for evolutionary reconstruction.
Very good. I think that sets up the context very well. One thing, Gar, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And so can you share with us a bit, in your own words, about your path to the work you're doing today? And feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, I'm a kid from Racine, Wisconsin, went to the University of Wisconsin, and then got a Marshall Scholarship and did a PhD at Cambridge University and became a fellow of King's College, Cambridge. And then I also served as a legislative assistant in the House of Representatives for a very, very liberal congressman, the late Robert Kastenmeier, represented Madison, the most progressive part of the state of Wisconsin. And later worked as a legislative director in the U.S. Senate for Senator Gaylord Nelson, who was the founder of Earth Day, a very famous environmentalist. And I spent about 1 year mainly to learn something about it at pretty high level in the State Department working on United Nations matters. So that's one part of the trajectory, of a little of experience as a historian and an economist and then government giving me a sense of what happens. But I very quickly learned in the late 1960s, and probably in the middle of the Vietnam War, where I became an activist after I left the government, that there was something in the current design that gave over a lot of power to corporations and the military sector, and that if we wanted to get beyond it, we'd have to think about how do you get from A to B to C, and most important, since the only other real model of a different system that people knew about was the Soviet Union, and very few people, and certainly not me, wanted that model, how could we say what made sense? How could we propose a different direction? And if we didn't know where we wanted to go, even in general terms, what were we saying to people who might be interested in going with us? You guys don't know where you're going. So it became important to me to really ask questions seriously about how could you think through in systemic architecture, design. It's a problem of design in a way. What really might make sense if you think corporate capitalism and state socialism don't make sense? So it became a problem for me as an intellectual problem. I was at the Institute of Politics at Harvard working on it as an intellectual as well as a personal as well as a political problem. And that takes you way back to the late 1960s when I first began thinking and writing about this and came to some thoughts that I've kind of modified, refined, and published several books on the subject, as well as stepping stones that might take us from A to B to C over time if we worked at it. So that's a short version of a long period of history, but that's how it happened for me.
Very good. And we come at this sort of from the same era. I think you're just a couple of years ahead of me as we come through this. And one of the things I want to note is that at that moment you're talking about in the early 70s when you begin to understand that the design, that the system is rigged for the corporations is about the time that Lewis Powell says, but not nearly well enough. And,
exactly.
And the aggressive actions which have accelerated this unbalance between labor and the corporations was really, as I say, accelerated with a very clear plan and a ton of money.
Yeah, that's a very good point. He was writing for the Chamber of Commerce at that point. He later became, Lewis Powell, later became a Supreme Court judge, very, very conservative. But he understood in precisely the same terms that I'm talking
about.
Yeah. The design was corporation-dominated capitalism, counterbalanced politically by the institution of the labor union in politics as well as on the shop floor. And he wrote from the Chamber of Commerce point of view, how do we destroy unions?
Yeah.
Because that's the only way to get our politics. And they mounted he had a whole war plan. It's called the Powell Memo. It's very famous in people who study this. A way to attack labor and a way to destroy the model so the corporations could dominate politics. And Ronald Reagan picked it up and went after the unions as well, not only because of wages and hours, but they wanted to break the model and leave it corporate dominated. And they were quite successful. We're seeing the success right now in the current occupant of the White House.
Absolutely. In your role as historian, your analysis includes your take that there have been four distinct systems since the founding of the country. The Northern, the Southern, the Gilded Age, the pale, if you will, the pale welfare state, and then whatever comes next. Can you just talk just a little bit about that to give people that context as well?
Well, let me simplify it a little bit because the beginning period, starting with the first, just at the time of the Revolution, there were about 4 million people strung out again along the Atlantic seaboard, a very tiny group, primarily small farmers, small business people, merchants, few people who had money who were controlling the transatlantic shipping, and then in the South, of course, slavery. But a very tiny group of people. And the design was, at that point, you could call it a certain kind of small business capitalism. It went through many variations on that, and ultimately, think about it this way, ultimately the whole principle was to expand that system. And indeed, they took over the entire continent, starting along this skinny little seaboard in the late 1700s, the 18th century. So that's the first model. At a certain point, and I'm obviously oversimplifying,
yeah,
and then we're talking about the North at this point, there began to be a concentration of capital so that there were larger corporations were built, some of them sponsored by the government and some of them independent, and beginning to build up large capital. And by the end of the 19th century, you have these giant corporations. And then slowly thereafter, at that point dominant, slowly thereafter, the buildup of labor unions to countervail them. This is all in the North. In the South, of course, the plantation system and slavery predominated until the Civil War, to the 1860s. And very shortly thereafter, there was a very short period of freedom. And then there was a massive repression of black, not slaves, but in a way made into another form of slavery for another 100 years until the 1960s. I mean, extraordinary. We don't think of it this way, but the Ku Klux Klan and violence against blacks in the South, even after slavery, went on for 100 years in our democratic, so-called democratic country. We have to really grasp what an odd system it was in the South, and still is in different ways, but not nearly what it was at that point.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the rise of the labor unions countervailing the corporations at the time of the New Deal and running through the early part of the post-war period until we get to Mr. Powell and Ronald Reagan and the all-out attack on labor and basically destroying the labor unions or running them down to tiny percentages, leaving the corporations dominant. And the basis of the current Republican Party.
Very good. And let me just say, for I realize, as I referred before, that our ages are somewhat similar, that I attended two high schools in Florida in the 60s, and both of them were integrated for the first time while I was in them. And my guess is that a huge percentage of listeners, and certainly a huge percentage of Americans, the civil rights movement is something in the history books. But as you mentioned, the rights really did not come until that shortly ago.
We think of, you know, Lincoln freeing the slaves. That's in the 1860s. But it was 100 years, an entire century. Think of that, an entire century of repression thereafter, after the Civil War, and in some cases worse than slavery in some situations. So we have a dark, dark path, but dark, dark history that needs to be dealt with. It's also, and this is how you bring it to the question we're talking about, it also is a systemic design. The repression of black people, allowing the wealthy in the South in the post-slavery period to dominate politics without allowing either black organizing and forbidding labor unions through right-to-work laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
a particular design that the South had, and like nothing like it in most parts of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you point out that, I'm going to read a quote that I found in one of your articles, I believe, just as the state socialism of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc encountered a crisis of legitimacy at the end of the 20th century, this global system, this EU, US, etc., global system of corporate capitalism is now having a crisis of its own. Now, in America, I think we clearly see the loss of labor unions, the rise of inequality, both in terms of income and wealth, and the dominance, the growing dominance of politics and government by wealth, whether it's multinational corporations, wealthy individuals, dark PACs, etc. How do you see this globally? This crisis?
Well, the different parts of the world are obviously in different structural arrangements. We're seeing good parts of Europe, and it's very dangerous. We've gotten through the last election without outrageous difficulties, but the same phenomenon a little slower in some areas, but exacerbated by the migration of many, many millions of people because of the Syrian war, bringing in an influx of Muslim people and people of a different culture, beginning to raise the same questions in Germany, in France, throughout Eastern Europe, violently in Hungary and Poland, where imposition of basically semi-totalitarian governments like the pre-war period have begun to emerge. But also, and this is the part that's really important to keep focusing on, the design is also changing. Labor unions are disintegrating throughout the continent. They were 86% at the peak in Sweden. They're now down, well down to the mid-50s and 40s. And Sweden, the country, the exemplar of social democracy, of liberal vision of the future, of a different kind of capitalist socialist vision, is now experiencing significant unemployment, significant inequality, growing inequality, and growing governments that are much more conservative. So you either get that trend in the Scandinavian countries, and in other parts, the rise of right-wing people challenging the current order. So we're just at the beginning of this phase in Europe, And I suspect it's going to get pretty ugly.
Now, the decrease of labor membership and power in Europe, is that the result of, country by country, of some version of what we've seen in America? Or is it partially the changes in the work we have to do and the way and the working arrangements that are arising because of that? You know, artificial intelligence, automation, gig economies, those sorts of things.
I think it's a combination of both. That the technology has a lot to do with it, and technological change and displacement, unemployment, weakening the traditional labor force, but also conservative attempts to weaken labor in various different ways in different countries. But the trend is clear that labor unions are declining throughout, steadily, slowly, faster in some countries, slower in others. And simultaneously, you're getting something like what we call right-wing populism, the current president representing it. But also in virtually all these countries, in greater or lesser degree, quite terrible in Poland and Hungary right now. But even in Sweden, the rise of this similar phenomenon of exploiting unemployment and scapegoating different parts of the movement. Similar and stronger in some forms, weaker in others, than what we have here.
Right. That as the working class and the lower middle classes' prospects weaken, the prospects for right-wing populism increase, and then they sort of feed on each other. Let me ask you about an experience you had early in this work of yours, because I think it's a good illustration of possibility, which was your experience in Youngstown, Ohio, in the late 70s.
It's a very interesting tale. There's a big steel company in Youngstown at that point, Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company, one of the biggest modern steel mills in modern, I say modern by mid-20th century standards. In 1977, quite a while ago now, it went down. They closed the plant, and 5,000 workers got pink slips and said, "You're out of business, we're out of business, and you're out of a job," period. Now, that's so common now around the country and around the world that it doesn't quite ring the bell that it did in 1977, I believe the date was.
Mm-hmm.
It was a national front page news on every newspaper, and in those days, CBS, NBC, ABC television, big stories, 5,000 people losing their job in one day, the collapse of a steel mill, the collapse of a city. It was a very, very dramatic kind of way of crystallizing what was going on in industry at a slower and less dramatic pace and kind of bringing it to national attention. The steelworkers in that town and the community leaders, particularly the religious leaders, got together and said, you know, we've got to do something. What can we do? And I had been doing a lot of, at that point in my work, I was doing a lot of work at the national level about the different forms of public ownership or worker ownership, different strategies on inflation. I was in the news quite a lot at that point. And so they called me in and said, would I be able to help as an economist? And I was delighted to go, and tried to do my best. I didn't know anything at all about steel in technical terms, but we had been working on the question of, all right, we know something about different ownership forms for small things like co-ops or worker co-ops are quite common. That's one way to do business that's not capitalist and not socialist or state socialist. But what do you do about a steel mill that about 5,000 people? And so we worked with the steel workers and the community leaders to design a worker community, double-barreled, community set partnerships with the workers in the ownership structure of this big mill, if we could put it back to work and get it going. And we got at that, there was a very creative secretary, an assistant secretary of HUD in Washington at that time, who went for the idea and financed, you know, very sophisticated study of how to do the technical part of building a new steel mill, which was viable. It could be done. In fact, the technology is now being used throughout the steel mills in the country now. The real question was, how do you finance it? It was a viable business proposition, the studies all showed by the top experts in the field. So the religious coalition of that town and the steelworkers began mobilizing public support all over the country, in fact, to build this model and with a view to making something like this happen elsewhere as well. And they did their homework and they did their politics. And the Carter administration committed, in principle, $200 million in loan guarantees to make the plan work. The word in principle is very important because after the election of 1978, the congressional elections, all of a sudden the money disappeared and the steel mill didn't happen. The Carter administration pulled back. We now think that the steel corporations got together and went to Washington. And at that point in time, the Steel Workers National Union, which didn't really like all these upstart guys in Youngstown who were very activist, didn't like very much what they were doing. Looks like the two of them got together with the Carter administration and decided to pull the rug out from under this. Let me say clearly, the current leadership of the steelworkers, and for many, many decades now, has been very progressive, but this was a different era back in 1977. What's important about the model, even though it failed, the Carter administration took the money away, is it began to create ideas about what could be done. So the follow-on is that throughout many parts of the country, but particularly in Ohio, you will find dozens and dozens of worker-owned companies, many of them stimulated by this vision of what could happen. And some very sophisticated ones we can talk about more recently in Cleveland, Ohio, that take the models forward to another level. I recently got a kind of an email and then a telephone conversation with a historian that's looking at the young Barack Obama's first jobs in Chicago. Uh-huh. And it turns out that the very, very early part of what he was maybe going to do, I think it didn't happen because the job switched, had to do with his desire to work on steel mills in Gary, Indiana, or in Chicago, right next to each other, stimulated by the vision that these guys in Youngstown of what you could do to own industry, neither by the government, state socialism, nor by corporations, but a new way. Communities and workers could own these things, and why not? So that gives you an idea of systemic design as well. Here you have a different way of thinking about who gets to own and control industrial development of any kind of industry, neither the state nor the corporation, but rather something that represents the community and the workers in a new model. And it's an example of systemic design that we can talk more about later.
Once an entity becomes a employee-owned, worker-owned, maybe community-owned, isn't it still a corporation? It's just a difference of ownership?
It is still a corporation under different ownership. It can be a cooperative. You can structure them legally as a cooperative design, which is one person, one vote. It can be a corporation with either, no matter how much stock you have, one person, one vote, or one person, as many votes as your stock. Mm-hmm. Those are variations on the theme. I tend to favor the more egalitarian forms, but they are corporations, and the control structure depends upon how you set up the design. That's a matter of choice, and there are many, many variations being experimented with around the country right now.
Okay, and you say that reshaping the system means, I'm quoting you here, imagining direct, public, social ownership of the major institutions of the American economy, the banks, the utilities, the investment funds, as well as corporations that are involved in manufacturing and service. And you cite some examples, Chattanooga, North Dakota, and General Motors and Chrysler. Could you tell people those, because they're three different sorts of examples?
Well, the principle is what we've been talking about so far, and maybe this would be a useful way to begin at the bottom. We're talking about, in Youngstown, a city-wide, large-scale, technically large-scale, big steel mill structure, which is community slash joint venture with the workers, owning and controlling. That's the model. If you go downwards to smaller scale, the model can include small-scale co-ops, some of them worker co-ops, some of them consumer co-ops, some of them agricultural co-ops, the kind of thing you can find in almost any city in the country now, are the credit unions. A credit union is a one-person, one-vote cooperative bank, and there are 3 million people in such institutions around the country right now. So those are different structures. If you go up in scale, and this is what becomes interesting and your question goes to it, what do you do about really big things? What do you do about the five big banks that control most of the big action in the United States, the ones that went down when Wall Street went down in the big crisis 10 years ago? What do you do about big stuff? So here you ask, there you have to go to the question of probably the workers, even in that big, big bank, don't represent the country, even though the impact of what the bank might decide could have vast impact around the country in general. So what do you do about the big things? Now, the traditional answer in many parts of the world has been that ought to be simply a public utility. And I think there's a lot of merit to that idea, that, and indeed in most parts of the world, there are big national public banks. This is conventional in many parts of the world now, not at all radical sounding, and if you went to Germany or Austria or Japan, this is quite common. Now, we haven't yet reached to that level, even though the big banks went down, causing a massive crisis, and right now they're eating away at the regulatory strategies that were put in place to try to deal with the problems that occurred 10 years ago, creating the, quote, Great Recession. But I think at the next time we have a big crisis, and I think there will be another crisis because the loopholes that are being driven into the system are causing undue speculation and very dangerous banking practices, the next time, or the time after that, people are going to say, you really can't regulate these big, big, big ones. And the other option, while I'm a great fan of Bernie Sanders, his option is, well, we should break them up in antitrust activity. And I think, while I appreciate the idea, what we know about antitrust break up the big ones is that they tend to get back together. That's what happened with AT&T. That's what happened to Standard Oil when we broke up these big ones. And I think it's kind of illusory to believe that if you broke up the big five big banks, they wouldn't get back together and be back at the trough again in a few years. So I think we're going to be forced ultimately towards some form of national public banking, which is, as I say, very common around the world. Our group has just published a very interesting study of how that's done around the world and what could be done here. A very technical, you know, understandable, but it goes through what other countries are doing. Is a very conventional way of taking the banking system out of politics directly.
Let me ask you two quick questions on that. One is a simple one, which is, if people wanted to find that study, is that at the Next System?
Yes, it will be at the Next System project, thenextsystem.org. It's going to be released in a couple of weeks. So it's by Thomas Hanna, Hanna. It hasn't been released yet, but it's just about to be released.
Okay, and then my other one is just to explain, in case people don't know or in case we went over it too quickly, what difference does it make if it's a public bank? And North Dakota has one, and several cities right now are talking about doing them. What are the distinctions and the benefits?
Well, the first, and I think it's really important to say this, there is one very, well, aside from credit unions, which are another form of public bank, and they're all over the country, the one-person, one-vote bank called a credit union, aside from that, there is in North Dakota, one of the most conservative states we have, for 100 years it has had a state-owned public bank, very successful, very much supported by small business, by cooperatives, by farmers, highly efficient, and at lower rates. If the costs are lower, the money available to finance businesses, housing, student loans, all of it paying better deals, if you put it that way, than most private banks. That model is being discussed in many, many parts of the country now at the local level. The advantages is, one, you have it, all the books are open to the public, so you can see if there's big profits being made. Secondly, the profits that are made go back into the bank and are used for public purposes rather than to finance big shareholders. many cities, and Los Angeles is one right now, which is on the verge of attempting to set up a public bank. The state of New Jersey may set up a state bank. The governor who won election campaigned on saying we should set up a state public bank like the one in North Dakota. I live in Washington, D.C. There's an advanced development here of a public bank. Philadelphia is another city. There are many, many cities now and many states now exploring this possibility as a way to use, in the case of cities and states, using taxpayer money, where are you going to deposit the taxes?
Yeah.
If you deposit in the private bank, they're going to make a lot of money on re-lending your money.
That's right.
If you put it in a public bank, the public makes money re-lending the taxpayers' money. And the, not only the money, but the multiplication, you know, banks lend more than they actually have because they know that they can, this is a little more complicated.
Yeah.
They can lend,
right.
They have to keep a certain percentage, but they can lend many times their actual asset base.
So what's the argument against a public bank?
Well, so far the main argument is that the people who own private banks want to make the money.
Okay. I got it. And it struck me as you were saying it. I mean, I've thought about public banks in the past, but it struck me a little bit like the discussion we have about healthcare, in that there's a certain amount of money in running private banks that does no one good except the people who own the banks. There's a certain amount of money in the healthcare system that does not serve the purpose of healthcare, just as that does not serve the purpose of investment or savings, because someone has to pull that profit out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, just to say a word about healthcare, which, I mean, this is, you know, when you think about it, this is a particular area that very dramatic changes. The U.S., compared with virtually every other advanced industrial country, all of them have some form of public health system compared with ours. In most cases, the share of the GDP, of the overall economy devoted to health in the United States is about double as a percent. It's about 18% to 20%, depending upon the year. In most countries, it's about 10%, roughly speaking, 9 to 11%. So about half the share of the economy going to health care. And in virtually all of them, outcomes in health are way, way ahead. We're at the bottom in almost every category in terms of outcomes. That is to say, diseases that are infant deaths. You name it, the statistics on it are well known, and they are double the share of economy and way at the bottom of the outcome list. So it's an outrageous way of using resources, let alone people who, the terrible things that happen to people because they can't get health care. But it's dominated by the big insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and, of course, the medical profession that likes it, and the private hospitals that like it the way it is and are very powerful lobbies. So that's a very important fight that could be transformative if we can win that one.
Okay, let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Gar Alperovitz, co-chair of the Next System Project at the Democracy Collaborative, and someone who, as you can tell, is thinking seriously about what replaces capitalism. You can learn more at garalperovitz.com. That's GARALPEROVITZ, garalperovitz.com.
Let me just underline what replaces capitalism and what replaces state socialism. Neither one of them worked.
We
needed to build a new model.
That's right. Well, yes. One of the things you point to is cities. And you say that cities, and it's interesting, you say cities, I'm going to read a quote here, are emerging as centers for social, economic, and ecological innovation and organizing, including piloting and sort of testing, a lot of the things you're talking about. And you point out that with their high concentration of politically progressive and radical residents and political leaders, their infrastructure, their supportive institutions, philanthropy, unions, and anchors, they are positioned to be, if you will, the lab of this next system. Talk a little bit about what's going on in cities.
They are not only positioned to be the lab, they are in many, many parts of the country, they are the laboratories where things are going on just under the surface of what's being reported in the national media. So there's a lot of development of experimentation with small and large-scale cooperatives, which are the alternative to private corporations and the alternative to state socialism, the cooperative form. And some of them are small-scale cooperatives. In Appalachia, you'll find a lot of technical ones that are doing weaving and textile development, for instance. But in some cities, and Cleveland, Ohio is a particularly interesting one, they are quite interesting and quite complex and quite large. So, and the design gives you an idea of where this can go over time. And I'm going to tell you about a British model that's a takeoff on this one. In Cleveland, there is, it's called the Evergreen Cooperatives. And the model is in a very poor neighborhood, black neighborhood, of about 40,000. Average family income, very low, about 20,000 per family. So it's a very poor area. Right in the middle of that area, 40,000 neighborhood, are three big institutions. The world-famous Cleveland Clinic, a powerful health institution, another health institution called University Hospitals, and Case Western Reserve University. So it's important to know that right in the middle of this very poor neighborhood, these big institutions, which have got a lot of public money in, Medicare, Medicaid, student money, educational money comes from the taxpayers, are fueling these big entities. Well, in that community, over the last, it's just reaching 10 years now, what was established, and here's your experimentation, a community-wide nonprofit corporation. That's the piece. That's the first piece, to which are attached large-scale worker-owned companies, the goal of which is not simply to make some workers some money, but to build the community, kicking back some money to the community-wide nonprofit, both to fund new worker-owned cooperatives as part of this structure. They're not freestanding. They're part of this community structure, nonprofit corporation, with the idea of building the communities. So it's a nonprofit for the community. It's something like Youngstown, but a little different. Community-wide joint ventures with these worker co-ops. One of them is a large-scale, industrial-scale laundry, serving the hospitals and nursing homes in the area. Another one is a solar installation and electrical new electrical systems company. And the third one is a industrial-scale urban greenhouse capable of producing some 3 million heads of lettuce a year, plus herbs, highly valuable herbs, that basil and others that make a good profit for the worker-owned company. So that's up and running now. There are about now 200 workers involved, and it's one of the largest worker co-ops in the country. Not the largest, because there's a big one that has to do with home care, but in terms of community-wide. And the interesting piece about this is these big hospitals and healthcare centers, like the Cleveland Clinic, they buy a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of taxpayer money, Medicare, Medicaid, other forms of government support. So the strategy has been, we call them anchor institutions, because they're pretty much anchored in the city. They can't get up and go like the corporations.
Mm.
Using that purchasing power, which is backed up by a fair amount of public money, to stabilize and build and buy from this complex community-wide cooperatives to rebuild the community and recycle some of that public money with that purpose. So that's kind of that's a model that takes co-ops to a whole other level and becomes a community building model, drawing on these on the structures that can't go, the anchored institutions, hospitals and universities usually. And we're seeing experimentation with that. Cleveland is the most advanced, or it was until recently. I'll tell you about the model. But we're seeing experimentation with this model in many parts of the country. And in Great Britain, they've picked up on the model, and in the city of Preston, which is a city of about 100,000, they've even gone further with the model, developing a whole series of land trusts, because if you start building in a poor area, you're going to get housing inflation unless you set up a nonprofit corporation to manage the inflation, called a land trust, which we can get into if we want to talk about it. We're seeing in Preston the same model, but much more sophisticated and much more fully developed. And in a Beacon, the Labour Party's picked that up and is trying to do that all over Great Britain. And some of the European countries are beginning to look at this model of how you start at the community level This is not state socialism. Quite the, just the opposite. Building from cooperatives and building from what you can do locally to a model, and only going to larger scale structures if absolutely necessary. So it's very, very, I'm a Midwesterner, I'm from Wisconsin, it's very, very much down home. Start at the community, start at the neighborhood level, start with the cooperatives. And if you have to go bigger, go bigger, but only if absolutely necessary for technological or other reasons.
Okay. One thing I want to point out and just get a quick observation on this from you, because we've got about 13 more minutes and I've got some big chunks I want to get to. But one is that in the article where I first learned about Youngstown and the Evergreen Project and so on, it seemed like there was, one is in 77, one is today, a lot going on in Ohio. And yet, you know, one of the key states to break for Trump was Ohio. And one thing that struck me was I looked at the breakdown. Clinton won each of Ohio's largest counties, Cayuga, Franklin, and Hamilton. And she won them by 360,000, right? The nine largest counties representing half the state's voters are rural. And no, that's the nine counties that Clinton won. She won by 360K. Trump won the other 79 counties, the smaller counties, by 800,000. Isn't a great deal of what's going on a clash between rural and urban? It's kind of in our history, but not just in the federal system, but in almost every state. And when 80% of the population lives in these cities we're talking about, where the experiments are taking place, how does your vision deal with that conflict?
Well, it's very important. We have been talking about mainly the big cities like Cleveland. Partly the word rural is a little complicated because we're talking in rural terms, and I'm from the Midwestern state of Wisconsin, similar patterns. Small towns in rural areas is what we're really looking at in many cases. I mean, there are farmers as well, but the farm population in the United States, real farmers, is down to 2%.
Right, right. When I say rural, I don't mean farming. I mean non-urban, if you will.
Yes, in small town urban. And I think you put your finger right on the most important single challenge that we face, and it's an area that I'm particularly interested in. How do we begin to take these principles, which, to be frank about it, these are laboratory experiments all over the country, and we're refining the principles and learning what works and what doesn't work. There's enormous experimentation, by the way. We're just touching the surface of it. You could, throughout California, you can find dozens and dozens and hundreds of experiments like the ones we're talking about, not particularly as advanced as the Cleveland model, but in banks and cooperatives and community land trusts, and we could go on and on. Under the surface, there is real ferment. It reminds me, let me just interject this, in the 1920s, most of what became the New Deal was experimented with in the cities and states around the country and then became models that could be taken national. And I think that's partly what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you put your finger on what I think is it's one of the biggest problems and one of the biggest gaps in the work. People have not been thinking about the small towns and what can be done there. There are a few experiments, some of them cooperatives in the parts of the state of upstate Wisconsin that we've been looking at. But I think that's the next area where we have to begin to look. And I know I've been talking to a guy who's running for Congress in Virginia, facing exactly this problem, and whether or not they could use some of the anchor institutions to begin to rebuild rural areas as the basis for helping stimulate a different form of industrial development. So that part, I think, is you put your finger on where the next area of real experimentation has to go. The other thing to say, I think at some point when the pendulum swings nationally, these kinds of ideas are going to have national backing. I think we're laying groundwork for that. And with national backing, putting the kind of funding in so that you could take a small rural town, and I'm thinking of several in northern Wisconsin, but the same is true in Ohio, and begin making them growth centers, that putting the kind of funding that you see in Cleveland into a particular part of a state where it begin to build out in a growth center along the lines of this different model. That's the next level of experimentation and development. We're in a very, very, just under the surface, and just under the surface of Mr. Trump's gaze, there is an enormous experimentation, and it's very important to get at it, take it seriously, try things, have failures, work out the next model, and begin to build from these principles. Very exciting things going on if when people realize how much is going on and where it could go.
Okay, so here's what we're talking about is a direct assault on old and dominant institutions, right? Whether that's
yes.
the way government is done, the way the lobbying business is run, the way corporations, I mean, now you'll have shareholder activism, but seldom does it actually get over the hump and so on. Old institutions have a huge advantage of scale and wealth to delay the inevitable. How will those political battles be won?
Well, I often say, as a historian, let me say two things. If you want to play this game, the price is decades of your life.
Mm.
Don't mess. We can always use help at any point from any age. And indeed, you know, what's really interesting, we're seeing in some of the most conservative businessmen in Cleveland, even a right wing, they love these models because they show what their hard work, their jobs, people ownership, very conservative principles in a worker cooperative. So they volunteer time to help. And they're, the old ideologues are running in Washington and all over television. But real, genuine conservatives, and I'm also thinking of some of the kids I went to school with, they're still my good friends from Wisconsin, they appreciate these models because they're real.
And they're based on values that we all share.
Values we all share and go well beyond conservative and liberal and radical rhetoric. Does this make sense? Does it work? How can it be done locally? So you, at that level, we're picking up, even people from the Chamber of Commerce wanted to help these co-ops and these job creations. So that's one piece. The other piece is I'm a historian as well as an economist. I don't think this is going to be easy business. I mean, I think we're in a very major crisis of both state socialism has collapsed all over the world, and corporate capitalism is in very difficult states. It will probably turn in some places. As soon as there's some kind of uprisings in Europe, you may see something that looks like fascism in Hungary already. If we have violence, there will be repression. This is a very, very difficult period. So the question is how you build through that period, the way Chile went even through a dictatorship and came out the other end. And so I have no illusions about how difficult this is. But the place to look for hope is in the rebuilding of what's happening on the ground and experimentation. I sometimes say to young students, you want to play this game? The chips that you have to throw on the table are decades of your life. That's what social change is all about.
Let me jump on that quote of yours. This is a question that I had anyway, but it really fits right now. And say we've got 4 minutes for you to answer this one. You're standing in the future. 10, 15, 25 years have passed. And this fits what you're saying about decades and generations. You're looking back. If we turn things around, how did it happen? So you're not constrained by what we need to do tomorrow or who we've got to fight with tomorrow. But you look back and you go, wow, that fork went the way we wanted. That one, have you played with that at all in your own imagination?
Absolutely. That's exactly. First, let me say, in Chile, they went right through dictatorship and came out the other end to a positive solution.
Yeah.
They faced that. Second, my heroes are people in places like Mississippi in the 1930s who laid the groundwork for the explosion in civil rights that occurred in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
three decades. But I think we're going to see this experimentation. I think the next stage will be some politicians will begin seeing the importance of this. The guy who ran for governor and won in New Jersey campaigned on the basis of let's set up a state-owned bank. Now, that was a breakthrough. Same is happening in your town, that you have support by the mayor, I understand, for a public bank.
That's right. What's one way to handle cannabis wealth?
Yep. That's and I think possibly at the state level too. There may,
yeah,
it may be
because
the next
of that
election.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're seeing people pick up some of these ideas, and worker co-ops are very common around the country now. They're bubbling up. Land ownership, land trust, that is neighborhood ownership of land to prevent gentrification so they can keep prices, housing prices down. The experimentation just under the surface is enormous. So I think the possibilities of that moving into the political realm, politicians seeing that this is makes sense, it's practical, and beginning to campaign with that, I think we're going to see that building up, even as Mr. Trump has his, you know, outrageous kind of politics of trying to divide and conquer. I think just beneath the surface, there's a building process. We just got an election in New York that knocked off one of the old-time Democrats by a young Democratic Socialist woman campaigning on new strategies. I think the future is with a long process. I have no illusions how difficult it is. But as a historian, I see that the current system is at a dead end. You can't get solutions other than very violent or polarizing solutions. So moving through a very, very muggy and ugly period, the key is to start at the local level and begin to build and to begin thinking about, you know, a lot of it's psychological. Most people think we can't overcome. They just don't imagine winning. And I think part of it is looking back historically at things like the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement in Vietnam. At the very beginning, it looked like you could never win. And indeed, winning occurred. Even Mr. Trump probably is a good example of that.
That's right. Let me say this is almost uncanny, and you will have very little time to respond to what I'm about to say. But this was my next question, which was a quote by you, and you'll see how it fits. Driven by fear or despair, more and more Americans are turning their back on the future, and I believe that a crucial element in shifting people's sense of what's possible. And I believe that shift can lead pretty directly to political change. Once people think it's possible, then they begin to act on it. A crucial element is a new American story, a compelling narrative that can drive Americans to yearn for the future rather than the past. And I had a conversation, a lot of my conversations recently are turning that way. And I spoke with Arlie Hochschild, who wrote Strangers in Their Own Land, right? And her sense of it was that it's time for a new frontier, because the frontier is so essential to the American character. And this frontier of this new system, of what happens with automation and artificial intelligence and how things are changing, that rather than hiding from this, that we've got to come up with a narrative that makes this the exciting path to take.
Exactly. And I think that I'm from Wisconsin. I lived in the McCarthy period. They all said nothing could happen, and then, boom, the 1960s opened up everything. I think we're in a similar place. But it means knowing what you want and thinking it through and beginning to say, let's build it here and then go forward. So I am, you know, it is possible that nothing can be done. But it is also possible that we will actually laying the groundwork for the future, and that's the place to put your bet.
Very good. So again, Gar's website is garalperovitz.com. That's GARALPEROVITZ, garalperovitz.com. You can also look at the nextsystemoneword.org and the democracycollaborative.org as well.
Yes.
Okay. You can get a free download of his latest book, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth, which really goes into everything we've been talking about. You can get that at thenextsystem.org/principles. For this conversation and many others, as well as articles and so on, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. One word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive a weekly announcement via email that tells you who's going to be on, but also gives you like 7 or 8 relevant articles to the moment or to the guest, email me at temcnally@mac.com or go on my site and sign up. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. It goes back about 10 years. Thanks to G, my engineer, Thanks to Kiana, also engineering, Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And Gar Alperovitz, keep up the good work.
Okay, thanks very much for having me.